You know, listening to 1A can help you make good decisions. I mean, think about it. We get expert guests to explain complex issues. We ask the questions that you tell us you want asked. We get you the answers you wanted, and we answer the questions you might not have known you had. Now, here's something else to think about. Imagine this kind of high-quality conversation like infrastructure for life. This podcast kind of paves roads and bridges that take you to better conversations with friends and colleagues, better decisions that fit your beliefs at the ballot box, more delightful discoveries about the world around us, and it's solid. No potholes, no detours, none of that. This type of infrastructure is not cheap, but it's a worthy investment. So support your local NPR station right now at donate.npr.org/1A. Thanks. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. It's a notion that goes all the way back to ancient Greece. De mortuis nil nisi bonum dicendum est. Translation, say nothing but good things of the dead. Decent advice, in general, but what about for presidents, like the late George H.W. Bush? How do we acknowledge their strengths and their faults? Now, President Bush does get praise for, among other things, signing the Americans with Disabilities Act or signing NAFTA into law. He also drew scorn over NAFTA, over how he handled the AIDS crisis, and over his campaign using the infamously racist Willie Horton ad. What should get said in an obituary? How do you say it? And when do you say it? We'll get to that after the break, and later, as preparations continue for tomorrow's state funeral for President Bush, we'll discuss the history behind these ceremonies. That's all ahead after this.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Megatrends, a new podcast from Oppenheimer Funds. There are big investment opportunities beyond our borders. Megatrends explores and explains those opportunities. The show is hosted by author and hedge fund specialist Manit Ahuja. Tune in to hear her talk to the experts about thinking globally when it comes to investing. Subscribe to Megatrends now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
Did you know you can ask Google Home to play NPR podcasts for you? It's easy. Just ask. Like, play the Fresh Air podcast. Use Google Home or Google Assistant to connect with your favorite shows anytime.
Joining us from KAMU Public Radio at Texas A&M University is Jennifer Murcia. She's an associate professor of communications, and she has studied presidential obits. Jennifer, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me on.
Jennifer, let me start with something you tweeted the other day. You wrote, quote, "No person perfectly lives up to communal values, and communal values change over the course of a lifetime. So remembering a person's life is political and strategic. We make choices when we remember." Unquote. Expand on that, if you would.
Yeah. So this was a tweet yesterday. As I was watching people sort of remember Bush, and some of it was being accused of being hagiography, and other people were being accused of being, not polite or whatever, being too mean, I started to think about it in a sort of meta level, which is the fact that, you know, when we remember a person's life, it's not about the life itself. We're not, you know, whatever we say about Bush isn't going to change the fact that Bush has died. He can't hear us. What we're talking about is communal values. We're talking about what we value as a community. And so eulogies are for communities. They are about helping us to make sense of the fact that someone who we respect or who has been in a leadership position, in this case, has passed away, and that there's a loss. So we have to make sense of that. But it's also about the fact that this person has died, but the community will live on. And so what is it about that person's life that we can say reflected the values of our community that we want to see move forward? And so the struggle that you see over remembering Bush and how and what to remember is really what we're supposed to be doing right now. We are supposed to struggle over this because it's exactly the conversation that a community ought to have about what we value.
It sounds like part of what you're describing is the way that an obituary, that the remembrance of a president, kind of reflects us back to ourselves.
That's exactly right. we don't spend a lot of time as a community thinking or talking or debating particularly what we should value, right? And so when you see, you know, Bush praised for passing the ADA, that's a value that is very much now, right? The segment that you just had was excellent in helping us to understand the struggle that still goes on with people with disabilities. And that is a current value that we want to implement and see move forward. And so we highlight that about Bush. He did a great job in that he started this path forward for the nation. And, you know, hopefully we can move forward. And it's a civil right. And so that's a conversation that we have because we value that, right, as much as we value what he did to help us with that.
There's also a part of these obits that is a reflection of our times. I mean, a number of commentators very soon after President Bush passed away made the comparisons between President Bush and President Trump, with President Bush saying that we should be a kinder, gentler nation, saying that our political adversaries don't need to be our enemies, and immediately using that as kind of a jumping off point to basically say, and now look what we're stuck with.
That's right. And if we had a different president right now, we might not be talking about those things with Bush. Mm-hmm. We might be talking about something else. And you're absolutely right. So in that case, Bush is being held up as somebody who upheld the dignity of the office of the presidency. And if you remember his presidency, he wasn't always remembered that way at the time. So it is very much in comparison to Trump. And yeah, that's part of the politics of the moment, politics of the remembrance of Bush that I think is so important.
There's that Latin phrase at the top, basically saying, you know, speak no ill of the dead, or, you know, some people say if you can't say something nice about somebody, don't say anything at all. That's something that clearly a lot of you listening are kind of wrestling with. Philip emailed, an obituary should be an opportunity to tell the unvarnished truth, including, in Bush's case, the white fear-mongering Willie Horton campaign ad. He approved the using of it. The whole man must be subject to history's scrutiny. I wonder, Jennifer, if the rules are different for politicians, or if they're presumed to be different. That's part of what we're wrestling with.
Well, yeah. So it's interesting because we will remember him both as a private person and as a public person. So there will be eulogies that are delivered by people who knew him intimately, and we won't get to be a part of those. And so maybe some of the concern over how we remember him is by people who want him to be remembered, you know, in that way that you would remember your grandfather or, you know, or your parent, which is to say that you wouldn't say anything bad.
Right.
But then there's the fact that he was, in fact, a public person. And so, again, the publicness of his life means that we do interrogate all of these things and we invoke the choices that he made. And not all of those choices were, of course, good. And maybe in the moment they were okay. But then now in retrospect, we think about that and we think, oh, that we shouldn't have done that. And so I think it's appropriate. Again, you don't want any political leader to be remembered only in one way, only positively. I think that's undemocratic, right? This is a democracy, and we ought to have different opinions about our political leaders, and ought to be able to express them.
Eric emailed, the first thing I learned about obits in journalism school was that they are, first and foremost, news stories. Overly glowing stories about the past can help misshape our understanding of issues that still exist today. Michelle writes, formal obituaries and eulogies are a time to honor the life of someone who has passed, not a vehicle for debate or an all-inclusive accounting of their life. In the case of honoring people who have served their country, their positive contributions and service are what is important. I wonder, Jennifer, if maybe we need to draw a distinction between an obituary and a eulogy.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I liked the point about the obituary being a news story. A eulogy is different. So obituaries obviously are written. They're written by journalists. They appear in the newspaper. Eulogies and remembrances and memorials can appear in lots of different places, certainly on social media, typically in a funeral situation. And so they are different, I think, in kind. People who attend funerals tend to be, you know, close to or have a sort of emotional tie to the person who's passed away. And so they don't need to be persuaded that this was an important person because they're there because that person was important to them. You know, and so they can have very different functions.
And as it occurs to me, Jennifer, I feel like sometimes the nature of a eulogy, the nature of the ceremony is part of the story of that president. I mean, the way that we reflect on them at the time is necessary to understand who they were to the people in that moment.
Yeah, it's fascinating. When I was a little baby undergrad, my first rhetoric class, I got very interested in Nixon's funeral because it was happening as I was in the class. And so I ended up writing a paper about Nixon's funeral. It's the first thing I ever wrote.
We should note, by the way, Nixon's funeral was at his presidential library and birthplace in California. He didn't have the big state funeral in Washington.
Yeah.
Right.
And if you go back and look at those eulogies, Clinton gave one, Robert Dole gave one, and they didn't, of course, mention Watergate, which seemed to me at the time to be a big thing. you know, how do you not talk about that? But of course, you know, if you were the president of the United States, as Clinton was at that moment, with his wife, you know, being involved in the Watergate prosecution, you know, and if you were Bob Dole, you wouldn't say those things. And so instead, they highlighted his Americanness. They highlighted his rags to riches story. He, you know, his determination, his fact that he spoke for America, that he never gave up. You know, so they really tied him in his life to these sort of all-American values, again, that you wouldn't necessarily think about when you just sort of think about the legacy of Richard Nixon.
I wonder, Jennifer, I don't want to go too far down a historical rabbit hole, but one of the things that I've read about, I think through your work, was the way that Thomas Jefferson and John Adams were reflected upon when they died. Both of them died on the 4th of July, 1826, 50 years after the Declaration of Independence was completed to the day. And the way that the nation reflected on that was really telling at the time in terms of what people trying to kind of make meaning of it.
That's right. I tell the story of my book, Founding Fictions, and it's a fantastic story. It's, you know, if we can say that it was odd that they died on the 4th of July, that they died on the same day, that it was the 50th anniversary, you know, what an unusual coincidence, we might think in retrospect. Imagine in 1826 finding out that two of the three signers of the Declaration of Independence had, you know, departed the scene, as they said at the time, at the same moment. And the nation had already been participating in patriotic panoply. They'd already been celebrating the Declaration of Independence and American independence for the whole year prior to their dying. So, you know, the Americans at the time, they thought it had to be a sign from God. And so the eulogies, and these were given in every small town, there were mourning and funerals and all kinds of demonstrations throughout the nation. And these funeral orations were all about trying to help Americans make sense of it. You know, it's a sign from Providence that they were taken from us. But is it a sign of the death of the Republic? Or is it a sign of the divine origine, which is the divine origins of the Republic? And of course, Americans at the time decided that it was a sign of the divine origine. Can't speak Latin today.
I already did the Greek. We can't have two dead languages, which is one of the time.
And so, of course, that meant that that the nation was under providential care, which is part of American exceptionalism, right? That we believe that this is a nation that has been blessed by God, literally. And so the twin deaths, the twin stars of liberty, as they called them, were taken as proof positive that this is a nation that is blessed by God. And so there's a lot of community sense-making that goes on when famous presidents die. It's fascinating to watch,
right,
actually.
And just to be clear, Greek is an ancient language. It's not a dead language. Please don't send me angry tweets over that. It's an ancient language. Before we go, I do want to talk to you a bit more about the coverage of obits. Joe writes, "Greetings from a longtime obit writer for a major newspaper. A newspaper obit is a news story, a mini biography for the record. It's not a eulogy. It should be interesting, comprehensive, and accurate." I should note, by the way, at some of the papers I've encountered, some of the best writers at the paper are the ones who end up writing the obits. It's obit writing is an art. Cynthia in Salem, Virginia writes, the first report on George H.W. Bush's death on NPR was an uncritical tribute and had no place on a news show. And Tommy in Raleigh, North Carolina emailed, NPR's glowing accolades to George H.W. Bush astounds me. These stories are the 180-degree opposite of what NPR said about Bush while he was alive. Both cannot be true. How does NPR square its recent glowing coverage with what you said about Bush 41 all these years? Now, to be clear, Jennifer, I'm not asking you to speak for NPR. I can't speak for NPR, and I know our time is short, but, you know, this is, I think, part of the challenge. And, Tommy, I gotta say, I disagree with you. You can criticize someone while they're alive and then not, you know, stomp on their grave when they're dead. So those two things can coexist, but at least in my view. But, Jennifer, how do you see it?
Yeah, so I have also been fascinated by the coverage and then also the responses to the coverage. I've appreciated those stories that I thought humanized Bush. So Peter Baker did this great story in the New York Times about his last moments that I thought was really compelling. I really enjoyed Maureen Dowd's personal story of her relationship with Bush, partially because I think, again, it's about the sort of communal values of the moment. And, you know, so she talks about this sort of adversarial relationship that they had between the press and the president, but that it was also, you know, sort of funny and loving in certain ways. So I've really appreciated those stories. I think part of the struggle is that we don't actually know how to think of Bush as a president. So when we ask historians, we ask political scientists, you know, to rank the greatest presidents, H.W. Bush, 41, comes in right in the middle. He's 22 right now out of 44. And so, you know, of course, there's going to be those people who, you know, are above him and below him and so are better and worse. And, right. And we sort of don't know how to think about him, you know, and his legacy. We like to think of him as a great foreign policy president,
yeah.
But maybe not so good on domestic issues.
One more aspect of the legacy that we obviously don't have time to talk about. Dana Carvey on Saturday Night Live. I feel like the way that we lampoon presidents is part of their legacy, too. But that's a conversation for another day. Jennifer Murcia of Texas A&M University. Her book is called Founding Fictions. Jennifer, thanks for talking to us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up, we'll go behind the scenes of state funerals with historian Matthew Costello. Stay close.
The following message comes from our sponsor, Capital One. Here's Sarah Strauss, head of fraud at Capital One, on how the CreditWise app helps users quickly take action by alerting them to potential signs of fraud.
It's really about actively trying to detect fraud as it's occurring. There's just a much greater opportunity now for consumers to really own this and to feel empowered to go after the issue and resolve it.
CreditWise from Capital One is an app that helps you quickly detect fraud for free, whether you're a Capital One customer or not. You can find CreditWise in your app or Play Store now.
Hey, just a quick reminder, your support is what keeps 1A and NPR on the air. We provide that rare space that promotes open dialogue, where everyone feels welcome and everyone feels heard. We are in no one's pocket but the pocket of those who keep us going. That's you. So please, make a donation at donate.npr.org/1A. Thanks. Preparations continue for tomorrow's state funeral for the late President George H.W. Bush. Many throughout the nation are in mourning. The federal government is shifting operations ahead of his funeral. That includes post offices, which will close tomorrow for the occasion. There won't be regular mail delivery either. But underneath the grief lay centuries of history and years of meticulous planning. Funerals and homegoings can take on many tones, but recent presidential funerals have come to encompass the pomp and circumstance of high diplomats or royalty. Have they always been this way? Is that relatively new? And who plans the funeral of a former or sitting president? Joining us in studio to discuss it is Matthew Costello, a senior historian at the White House Historical Association. Matt, welcome to 1A.
Thank you for having me.
Matt, how long have presidential funerals, these big formal affairs, been a big deal, a matter of state? Were they always?
No, they weren't always that way. With the early presidents, a lot of the funeral arrangements were primarily done by family members. So when we look at the early presidents in the 19th century, starting with George Washington, you know, even though his first funeral sort of had elements of that in terms of size, it was still a private affair. It was at Mount Vernon, and he was entombed at Mount Vernon. So since then, it's evolved, and it's had to evolve based on what has happened to whoever's in the office. So when the first sitting president, William Henry Harrison, dies in 1841, that's really the first call for what we would think of as a state funeral today.
And William Harrison died, he was like a month into being president, I think.
It was about 30 days.
Yeah. So it kind of caught the country by surprise. We hadn't even really sussed this out yet.
I mean, the first lady hadn't even gotten to Washington. So it was pretty unexpected. And that was really the first attempt to create what we would think of as a state funeral. So for Harrison, they had a funeral service in the East Room of the White House. They transported his body, his casket, on a military wagon called a caisson. And that was actually taken through the streets of Washington to Congressional Cemetery. So that's really where we see the first instance of a state funeral, and then more additions were added to it later, starting with Lincoln in 1865.
This feels like a challenge for a young country like America, because we had thrown off a monarchy, and we know that, you know, when a monarch, you know, the king is dead, long live the king, and it's all this pageantry, and, you know, the colors are rolled out, and the crown passes from one person to the next. But we were a nation that threw that off, mm-hmm. and so I wonder if part of the challenge or part of the evolution of this is figuring out what's appropriate for a nation that decidedly said, that's not us. We're mm-hmm. something else, but we're not that.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, this was the case with Washington, probably the most prominent figure that, you know, even George Washington grew to have enemies by the end of his term in the office. People accused him of desiring to be a monarch, of wanting a crown. So our mourning rituals have to reflect that dynamic and also try to reconcile these ideas of American democracy with the ideas of hero worship. It's something that Americans have struggled with, but we've paved our own way, certainly. We don't follow things like other European countries or other countries around the world.
How do you think we began to kind of suss that out? Was there a point at which the state funeral for a president became a little bit more mm-hmm. regimented, where we settled into a pattern, into a motif?
I would say probably starting with Abraham Lincoln, because that's where we see a lot of the elements of the modern state funeral. But then you also look at the historical context of what happened. You know, it's April 1865. The Civil War is essentially finished. The Union Army has won. 4 million enslaved people have been freed. And when it should be a time of reconciliation, of hope, of joy, Lincoln is tragically assassinated. So this is a particularly horrific end to his presidency. And I think that opens the door to this idea of a state funeral being about a lot more than just the person who's being honored, but it's about each individual citizen's relationship to that person.
We also kind of reflect ourselves onto these services. I mean, mm-hmm. we were talking earlier with a professor who studies presidential obituaries. Mm-hmm. And so the nation, like when Thomas Jefferson and John Adams died, they died on the same date, mm-hmm. July 4th, 1826, 50 years after the completion of the Declaration of Independence. And so the circumstances kind of made us as a nation go, oh my God, what does this mean? And I'm sure that's reflected in the way that we choose to lay these presidents to rest.
Yeah, I mean, there's these moments in American history where not only do we lose the former leaders, but there can be circumstances that are unfolding right at that time that also make it seem much more poignant and important and significant to fully understand. One of the examples I often think of is, you know, President Richard Nixon was just starting his second term. And in a matter of months, former President Truman and then former President Lyndon Johnson passed away. And at that point in time, in 1973, there were no former American presidents living anymore. There was nobody who understood the pressures of the office, nobody that Nixon could ask advice to. So it's interesting kind of the context of not only do we lose leaders, but, you know, sitting presidents lose colleagues in a way.
As we speak, the rotunda of the U.S. Capitol is filled with well-wishers and onlookers who are standing by as the president lies in state in the Capitol rotunda. I wonder how much, Matthew, of this whole process gets planned when? Like, when is the first conversation? When was the first conversation about how George H.W. Bush would be remembered? Was that when he took office?
These conversations happen while the president is in office. So there is a plan already in place. Just in the event that something happens while the president is the sitting president of the United States. But then post-presidency, these plans are revisited every year. It includes the president, the former president, the former first lady, but then also the family members who will weigh in on different things. So obviously, you know, funeral plans can change, but logistics, when you're talking about, you know, taking the remains to usually it's a state capitol or a state assembly, then to Washington, then back to a presidential library, there's a lot of other logistical planning that is done and planned ahead of time so that when the moment occurs, that the government can react quickly and plan the state funeral accordingly.
Is that kind of the template where it's a state location, at least in President George H.W. Bush's case, it was in Houston. He was flown out of a base in Houston to Washington and then back to Texas. Is that like the template?
Yeah, so I would say this is a much more recent thing that we've seen with the American presidents, and it coincides with having them be buried at presidential libraries. That's something that's sort of unique to the last 50 or 60 years, starting with Franklin Roosevelt. Franklin Roosevelt was a sitting president. He passed away down in Georgia. He was transported by train up to Washington. He had a service in the East Room, but he decided not to lay in state in the Rotunda because he thought as long as the country was still fighting the war, that was not something that he wanted while American GIs were still fighting. And then he's taken by train up to Hyde Park, which was his former home, now site of his presidential library, and he had donated the site to be given to the U.S. government at some point. So starting with that, many of the presidents since then have followed Roosevelt's lead, the exception being John F. Kennedy, who's at Arlington, and Lyndon Johnson, who's buried at his family property in Texas.
Also, in terms of the locations of where presidents are buried, there's only one president, as I recall, correct me if I'm wrong, there's only one president who's actually buried in the District of Columbia, and that's Woodrow Wilson. He's interred at the Washington National Cathedral.
Yes. So he's in a way, he's a part of all of these memorial services. And then the actual funeral services themselves. He's the only president interned in the district.
I'm sure a lot of folks listening have had to plan a funeral for a loved one. And under the easiest of circumstances, it can be a lot of logistics. What are some of the logistics that go into a presidential funeral, a presidential memorial, that maybe the average person would never have to deal with? I presume security is top of the list.
Yes. So when we're talking about the overall planning, a lot of this is done by the Department of Defense Joint Task Force for the National Capital Region, and that'll include coordination with the United States Secret Service, Department of Homeland Security. Depending on if you have foreign dignitaries or foreign heads of state, then you're talking about the Department of State as well. And then you also have the Military District of Washington, which oversees all the military ceremonies. So the armed force servicemen and servicewomen who are you know, standing in attention, presiding over the casket, a part of the processions, the pallbearing. I mean, there's many, many things that go into this so that the American people and that president get the final goodbye and that they do it right.
What about the guest list? There was a lot made of the fact that President Trump is going to President Bush's memorial tomorrow. President Bush made no secret of his disdain for Donald Trump and made it clear that he did not vote for him in 2016. What about managing the list of people who attends and just the optics of that?
So those lists are part of the annual review. So the president and the first lady revisit those lists with family members, with staff. And ultimately, it's their call who is invited and who is not. So obviously, the Bushes and the Bush family see this is about extending the same welcome that they would to any sitting president. It's interesting because somebody asked me a similar question about the eulogies, and they were wondering why a sitting president wasn't delivering a eulogy. So I had to do a little bit of research myself, and I did find historical precedents where, for example, Lyndon Johnson, at his funeral, Richard Nixon attended, but he didn't deliver a eulogy. Same thing with Harry Truman. Richard Nixon attended, but didn't deliver a eulogy. So there are precedents for it. I mean, ultimately, it's up to the president. It's their final wishes, who they want to speak on their behalf.
John emailed, as someone who works in the funeral industry and worked on funerals for police, military, politicians, etc., I can say that often the organization steamrolls the family of the deceased to, quote unquote, give them a proper funeral without any consideration for the wishes of the next of kin or others. I've seen the family basically dragged along as organizations do all the pomp and circumstance they want, but the family doesn't, and their wishes are all but ignored. Are there certain considerations, Matt, that just kind of come with the territory of being a president who is laid to rest that just kind of might override the family's wishes? Or does the president really get it the way they want it?
The president gets it the way they want it. I think the best historical example that I can think of, I mean, we're talking about pomp and circumstance and state funerals, but if you look at former President Harry Truman's funeral, he opted not to lay in the Capitol Rotunda. He opted to not have a service or even have his remains brought to Washington. He did everything in Independence, Missouri, because that's who Harry Truman was, and that's how he wanted to be remembered. So ultimately, it's up to the president. The family will obviously put in their two cents, but what the president says essentially goes.
Jonathan tweeted, "I think this discussion on funeral planning is important to stress that everyone should plan." Well said, Jonathan. It is never too soon to start thinking about things like this, for sure, because it can become an overwhelming amount of considerations later on in the process. I wonder also, Matt, about the religious aspect of a state funeral. I mean, Washington National Cathedral is not a federal property. It's the seat of the Episcopal Diocese of Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. So it's not like a government cathedral. But, you know, the way that we do memorial services has changed over mm-hmm. time. I mean, it made a difference that, you know, when John F. Kennedy was remembered, he was a Catholic president. So that mm-hmm. changes the service. You know, we are much more ecumenical now in the way that we do memorial services. How does just the faith aspect of mm-hmm. a memorial factor into the planning and the execution?
Yeah, I mean, that also depends on the president that you're talking about. So you mentioned Kennedy. And being a Catholic, the first Catholic American president, and he had his service at St. Matthew's Cathedral here in Washington, D.C. A number of presidents have followed Dwight Eisenhower's lead, having a funeral service at National Cathedral, and that was especially important to Eisenhower, that particular site. And it's sort of, in a way, sort of become the pseudo Church of the Presidents in many ways. Since then, we've had Gerald Ford, Ronald Reagan, and now George H.W. Bush. And my guess is I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, President Jimmy Carter or George W. Bush followed suit, because really it's, you know, because of the national cathedral context, the relationship with presidents being there for the laying of the cornerstone, but then also the completion of that incredible cathedral, and the fact that it's in the heart of Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, it's just a very fitting place to do this.
And by the way, if you ever get a chance to come to D.C. on vacation, go see the cathedral. See the cathedral and ask about the stained glass panels that are down low at your level and all the way up at the top of the cathedral. Mm-hmm. Definitely worth seeing. One last thing, Matthew, before we let you go. This is the kind of ceremony where surely a lot of things can potentially go wrong because there are so many moving parts. Mm-hmm. How do you know if a service like this goes right? What's the, for lack of a better word, goal of a presidential memorial?
I think for the family and for the former president, it's about saying goodbye. It's about closure. It's about giving as many people as possible an opportunity to pay their respects. And that's what the rotunda does. That's what the viewings do. But we also see these types of mourning rituals take place at other places. For example, the presidential libraries will put books out, as will our organization. We have a condolences book at the White House Visitor Center, which will be there for the next 30 days here in Washington, so people can pay their respects that way as well.
Matthew Costolo, the senior historian for the White House Historical Association. Matt, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
This show was produced by Morgan Givens. You can learn more about him and the rest of our staff online at the1a.org/staff. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.